Hello and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with Dylan Titchener, ACE, and Craig Wood, ACE, about their work on the latest Marvel extravaganza, Eternals. I last had a chance to talk to Dylan when he caught Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread. Dylan's work has included Boogie Nights, Magnolia, an Ace Eddie nomination for the Royal Tenenbaums, a BAFTA and Ace Eddie nomination for Brokeback Mountain, an Ace Eddie and Oscar nomination for There Will Be Blood, and BAFTA, Ace Eddie, and Oscar nominations for Zero Dark Thirty. And I have no idea why there weren't nominations for his work on one of my favorite movies, The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. Craig has also been on Art of the Cut before for Ant-Man and the Wasp and Guardians of the Galaxy. Craig won an Ace Eddie for Pirates of the Caribbean: The Curse of the Black Pearl and was nominated for Ace Eddies for The Pirates of the Caribbean: Dead Man's Chest, Pirates of the Caribbean: At World's End, Rango, and Guardians of the Galaxy. Craig's been working on film, TV, and music projects as an editor since the late 1980s, including projects for Peter Gabriel, Tom Petty, and Janet Jackson. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. The two of you guys have both edited very different movies from each other. How did you both end up on this? Let's start with Craig.
I guess Marvel suggested me to Chloe, and we interviewed together, and we liked each other a lot.
So Dylan, what about you? Same thing. Did Marvel call you?
I received a call from Marvel and director Chloe Chow and had a good long Zoom with Chloe. That was fantastic. I knew her movies, but thought that she just had a really exciting vision for the project and a lot of energy and enthusiasm. And so was really happy to be part of it.
Would it normally just be a director that would call you, or is this more of a producer kind of decision?
From my perspective, yes, I'm used to getting reached. Well, it's producers and directors, mostly directors, but certainly the Marvel, you know, other studio projects, you go through sort of a little mini gauntlet where you meet the head of post and a VP or something, you know, depending on how important things are. I sat down with the head of Warner Brothers Studios once before a project. So it has run the gamut, but certainly Victoria Alonso and Chris Russell run the post over there, and I met with them as well.
Chloe Zhao edited her last movie herself. So what was she like as an editing collaborator? Craig?
The first cut of the movie is while Chloe was actually directing. So she was pretty much not involved. Occasionally we'd see scenes and talk about them, but mostly it would be just up to Dylan and I to come up with the first cut, which I always think is a great thing for a director to be able to look at their film as in one piece and just go, is it even approaching what I had in my head when I was shooting it, and react to it fresh. She does bring quite an editor's perspective with her as a director, and that's incredibly useful.
And so that obviously comes out further down the road as you're watching the thing in context. Dylan, can you speak to that sense of her as an editor?
The films before Eternals are very strong fundamental style. It's docudrama a little bit. She uses a lot of non-actors. She takes real life stories often and then dramatizes them without too much hyperbole. I mean, she did that with Nomadland. That's from a book, so that was clearly, you know, a specific thing. But I think her editing style comes out of that, where she's mainly focused on getting all the little character bits that she would like to inform the performance and the character in there, however that can happen. And that, I think, was her main sort of focus over the months. That's mainly what she would focus on. And she would go through sort of older cuts to see, oh, did we get off the rails at some point? Was there something interesting we left by the wayside? And all, you know, we did myriad versions of many things on the movie.
That was kind of the hardest part of it was deciding which of those little moments to include. And we did multiple versions of some sections of the film to just get the balance of the characters and their relationships and actually how the characters played in the film.
You know, she's very sophisticated film watcher, Chloe. You know, she's super smart, obviously, but she understands film language. And so I think the three of us, we tried a great many things and went around in lots of circles, but almost universally, I think you could say that we agreed that things were worth trying. We understood what she was trying to do when she came to us with the thought. She understood what we were trying to do when we presented things to her. So in that way, it was very much like banging things around in a cutting room. She was a director with a more in the trenches sense of editing. Yeah, it was really useful, to be honest, because often she would present her ideas to us as sort of mini cuts or rough cuts. Like I was thinking this part from the assembly and this part from that and this part from this other cut. And what if we use this take instead of that take? And here I've thrown it together and it's sloppy, but can you, does this idea grab you? And then she would let us take it and do what we wanted with it. But it was a good shorthand for her because I honestly think she is more of a visual thinker and communicator. You know, she
sometimes just had to push it around herself before she knew, you know, actually go in and see what was available, look at older versions. Often our very first part of the film would come back again. Many of them became the final version. You know, there was no ego involved. It was just, oh, I'm liking this.
You start with something, you move on to a different idea, and you might come back to that original idea, but there's a value, at least in attempting some other idea.
Well, there's other things that come out of that journey, like the things that go around that idea. When it was in the film in its long cut form, it functioned differently than now we've moved a bunch of other things around. That original version of this piece is much better in this context.
And to your point, Steve, you know, you have to go around the back of the barn to realize, you know, there's nothing there for you, or to find the thing that you left behind originally in terms of trying other ways to skin the cat is always educational. You may end up going back, but you learn something in the journey, without a doubt.
Do you feel like Chloe's communication is different than a typical director? Is it just her style because she edits?
Not really, other than the fact that she likes to do some experiments on the side. I haven't had that from a director before. So that type of communication is new. But the way we talk about things, it's still about the ideas and the way the characters work and all the things directors talk about.
And she comes at it from a writer's point of view as well. And often that's the stronger angle. Even through editing, she's coming at it as a writer. I mean, arguably, she edits like a writer. I think, as I said before, she sort of lines up the things that she would wants to convey. And that's what the edit is. It's very writerly. She's emotional and also cerebral, as both of us as well. So
how much do you two guys feel like writers?
I always describe editing as the final rewrite of the movie. Yeah, we're often asked to write lines to link things because we've taken something out. A lot of writing falls to us and the director in the post-production process.
Lines, character motivations, backstory, story, plot. A lot of writing happens in editing, as you yourself know. And then I think in movies of this size and with this malleability, not only is Marvel not afraid to do additional shooting and get things if needed, there's often more opportunity because we can think of shots and sequences and make them to tell the story better. One of my great joys or things I look forward to is talking to the writers usually after or towards the end of the process where they see, oh, you guys did all this stuff. And not in a sense of, oh, we just like peed in your cat box, but more we're all working on it together. You guys did the first leg, we did the second leg. Here are the ideas we came up with to solve the problems that we've all been wrestling with. And it's sort of like meeting up with your World War II buddies who knew what it was like to be in the trenches. And it's I would say more than almost anybody, the writers sort of get what we deal with in the cutting room.
Certainly on this film, that was the case. They were curious to see the finished film and see how we finally solved many of the problems that they had throughout the process. And they had gone through many of the solutions that we then came up with again in the post sequence.
Yeah, I mean, just to interject, not only did Chloe go back digging through older cuts, she also did that with the script. Or she would go back to earlier versions, because we're trying to solve things that people had been thinking about for 3 years. Often before you're crazed and panicked, exhausted and confused, you come up with a really organic, strong idea. And that's how it comes off the truck, or the sort of first thing out of the gate. And they're always worth looking at.
She herself forgets, and she goes back and she goes, that was what we were originally trying to do. Let's get back to that.
And when you're telling sort of stories with really big moving pieces in terms of plot and character and time jumps and things just work differently once you've put it together. And certainly with Marvel, there is an expected rhythm to the storytelling. The groove in the road is really well worn after 25 movies, and rightly so. You know, it works. It speaks to people's appetites. Imagine being in a car in well-worn ruts and you try to turn to go a little bit outside the rut. You're feeling that, and then you pop out and you go, oh no, now we're in a dialogue scene for 5 minutes. How did this happen? But the balance of backstory, character, plot is I mean, that was our biggest challenge, without a doubt.
So what kind of feedback or solutions did you guys consider to try to keep that interesting and engaging?
We were going to hand out a little pamphlet at every screening.
I didn't get one of those at my screening.
It's just, you've got to love the characters.
And it's a struggle. You are constantly adjusting that dial. Too much information, not enough information. Information at the wrong time, information at the right time. And it is like you are painting or sort of carving something very delicately, just trying to keep it on the track. And arguably, it's maybe a losing battle because of the things we were just discussing about people's expectations and the needs of the story, given the constraints of the genre. And I think exposition is a really difficult thing to write well. And I think a lot of it in this movie is written well, but oftentimes the phrase info dump is out there for a reason. You just need it. And people sometimes think, oh my God, they, you know, sort of stopped the movie to show me all this stuff, or what is all these words they're throwing at me? When from our perspective, it is the most efficient, least disruptive way to do it. We've tried not doing it. Doesn't work. People are not on board the bus and the rest of the movie fails. We've tried doing it very lightly and wedging it in, confusing. We've tried doing way too much, stop the movie. So we've really tried to dial in. So this is what you need to go forward and be satisfied. Sorry. There's a piece of broccoli on the plate. Sorry.
When you are world building, you just have to, because you can't resort to a normal, this is the world I understand, therefore there's a shorthand to how much you have to know. We're creating a world. So you've got to give them the backstory, because it doesn't exist any other way.
And you can do it in a different way, much more organically, quote unquote, but, you know, add another hour to your runtime, because that's what's required. If you want to not feel like you're getting an info dump, then that requires us to work it into scenes. And it's the lesser of two evils, almost, to be frank about that. Nobody wants to read a movie. In order to tell you the meat of the story, you need a little bit of vegetable.
And you know, through our preview process, it was a lot of just how much information do they need? This amount of information in, too much. This amount of information out, not enough. Sometimes if you give them too much information, they want even more. But if you give them just the right amount of information, they're okay with not knowing anymore. They don't know the more they don't know.
That's that balance between having questions that need answering and being confused. And often it's a razor fine line, because we want them to have questions so they lean forward and want to watch the story, but we don't want them to be confused.
And my big question is, when do you start subbing the previs out of your edit, if it's in the edit at all?
And I would say for a movie of this size with this much stuff in it, we had relatively less previs than I would have expected, then I'm sure Craig would have expected, for various reasons, but I think mainly because Chloe works differently. Previs is really essential for working out camera angles what action's needed. Chloe sees things as a shot that's real. And I think largely until she has a camera with a lens on it and gets a shot, that's when she can really feel it. Usually the process is boards, pre-vis, and then there's a sort of phase where in sequences like that, you can get stunt vis, where the action's done by the stunt players, even just rehearsal, so that you can sort of get an idea of the blocking and what the action is. And then once it's shot, there are stunt players in it. Craig and I have done our work, re-speeded it and done all the cutting. And then post-viz puts creatures, digi-doubles, whatever, in the shot so that it is an actual plate with temporary digital representations in it. And then that gets subbed out, as you say, as we get versions from vendors.
Very interesting. So sounds like the early stages of the edit require a lot of imagination from you guys.
Oh, yes. But we've got the post-viz team working with us the whole time. So when we need something to actually help us
tell the story,
we can ask for it and actually say, can it be like this? So we're doing a little bit of directing of that while the cutting's happening.
Big time. I mean, a lot of ideas happen in that stage where you're trying to work out, how does this work the best? Does he shoot first, or does the creature jump and then he shoots? And does it land with his paw on one side or the other? How does it work? And you work it out by iterating back and forth with post-viz generally and try to work most of that out before the vendors actually come in.
And to communicate some of our ideas to Chloe. You know, there's all the communication going on.
Yeah, so she's busy shooting. If we're talking about stuff that's happening during shooting, we work out with post-viz a way to tell the sequence that we've constructed. And a lot of that is to show the director and the producers and other department people who need to know, this is what we think the idea is. This is the kind of powers that are going to come out of his finger. And then the eyes light up on this frame and this seems to work. And that's just part of figuring out how to tell the story. As you're saying, it requires imagination to get the idea across.
This movie was particularly difficult from the post-viz sense because we have so many creatures, and that's unusual in the Marvel films. There's not usually so many. And they all require animation, which is much more time consuming in the post-viz realm. So the feedback circuit was a lot longer.
A lot of those fantastic visuals were also supported with great sound design. How much were you given by the sound team early on, like a little toolkit or something?
We were given a certain toolkit, but we borrowed from a lot of other Marvel films sound effects. I created my own toolkit. I put what I thought they sounded like in my head for our film. And that helped inform me as to how to talk to the sound department when they were making the real sound effect.
And honestly, they take a lot of inspiration from the thinking and temping that Craig and I have done.
And,
for sure.
And it sort of informed us as to, oh, this has to sound different to this in that way, just in a frequency range.
Really hard when you have so many characters with different but similar energy. They all use quote unquote cosmic energy or celestial energy. And the original thing or the end goal is if you close your eyes, you could just by listening know which character is doing what. We really tried to do that and to make it organically related. In the middle of post, we did many sessions, Craig, Chloe, and I, with Addison Teague, our sound designer, just discussing. And then he would go away, work on stuff, play stuff for us, taking inspiration from what Craig and I had temped and then building on that to sort of really make it great.
The story switches tone quite a bit. How did you modulate those tones and the tonal shifts?
Well, it's probably one of the more difficult things we had to do. Once again, it's the rhythm of those things. So, you know, you would occasionally remove a joke that might actually be funny because it spoilt the drama of the scene. Sometimes we would add a joke just as the button to get us out of the drama of the scene.
You know, one of the challenges with this movie related to that is the Marvel sort of formula where there are quips and asides, even within the context of a dramatic scene or a tense moment. Marvel fans have come to expect and roll with the sort of funny aside And I, honestly, that also comes from comic books. Comics did that too, where there would just be a little snarky comment in the middle of something. You know, it's just the Stan Lee kind of style, really. Managing that in a movie like Eternals that has arguably 10 times as much drama as a normal MCU movie wasn't easy. And we wanted there to be humor in it, and there was room for humor. But I think making those shifts in time period from, you know, sort of dark, scary to action, and then there's little quips within the action, and then you realize, oh, I'm in another mode here. It's disconcerting in a fun way, but the characters themselves are often pretty serious. So trying to wedge some humor in there, yeah, we tried a lot.
How are you guys monitoring visuals and audio in your cutting rooms? And then did you need to check it on a bigger screen for pacing or something else?
Well, nice. For multiple reasons, we work in 7:1, so we have that to just monitor all the time. But then it's good to take our Avid sequence, the whole movie, and watch it in a screening room.
With the lights off, you're sitting in a chair. It's a different vibe.
It refreshes the way you look at it in your one environment all the time. You put it in a new environment and it's suddenly fresh again and you can judge things better.
And new ideas come into your head. Whereas when you're in the trenches and sort of working with your nose to the grindstone, you're solving problems and coming up with ideas. You don't see the big picture, especially a movie as complicated as this.
It was very useful having put the soundtrack together in 7:1 and actually mixed it before COVID hit. And then we had to work from home for a period of time just in stereo. Having already mixed it, it just meant things had to be balanced to that level. So anything that we changed, you could easily place in the stereo, in the surrounds, be monitoring in just stereo.
Craig and I went back to the cutting room, just the two of us and our post Super Adam, kind of leading up to our first screenings to do final touches, but also let's get into the real audio monitoring situation so we can make sure everything is where it needs to be. And it added almost a year to our schedule. You know, we were down, like fully down for 2+ months and then started back, you know, and there were good things about that. We all got a rest and we got a little perspective.
And we could look at it nice and fresh when we came back. I actually thought, this is a good idea. Let's do this on it.
All movies should do this. Yeah, we did. And that was very helpful, especially to VizFX, because actually later in the process, Craig and I sort of went away. There were still a great number of shots in the pipeline and the cut was basically done, but we had to let them catch up, as it were, because not only were we saturated, meaning the sort of studio people, but all the VFX houses, because everything down for a year, everybody went home, went to other jobs, whatever. And then all these movies that were backlogged in the pipeline, most especially at Marvel, but across the board, just came out. And so the VFX houses just got slammed.
I've got a question. I just have never worked on a film of this size. And I know on smaller films that I've worked on, I'm very much the manager of the process. I mean, there's a post soup, sure, but I feel like I'm in charge of the assistants. I'm in charge of the workflow. On something of this size, are you more being managed? Are you like head down, I just have to edit, and then someone else is figuring out schedules and doing other stuff?
It's yes to both. I at least like to be managed a lot as well.
Well, and we have to be, because you do have to nose down and do our work and keep our head focused. Craig and I think have very similar styles, where we have opinions and contributions to make to the designing of the schedule and what's going on, what makes sense, what's fair and sensible to the myriad people behind us in all the departments, from our assistants, VFX, music, sound. They all follow behind us waiting for the reels and the changes and the direction. And so that management, we're very much a part of how to do. We had Adam Cole, our post super, was just amazing. He manages the schedule with the other people in the post department, and they did a fantastic job.
They finished at this moment?
They're not. I actually heard there's a couple subtitles changing this morning.
Oh my goodness.
Well, it's a really funny thing, because Lauren, who plays Makari, speaks with ASL, sign language, which is a unique challenge. I've had deaf characters speaking sign language in a movie before, but you know, the way that you subtitle them and making sure to be very accurate with the subtitles so that what they're signing is exactly what you're saying is what you want to do. That's the goal. However, like we do with speaking characters and everybody in movies, sometimes you have to sort of zhuzh the line a little bit add a word or change a word to give it a slightly different inflection, because that's part of the story that you're trying to tell. Makari says, I had to go get this in order to trade, but we need her to say the word tablet, which on set they didn't realize. So we add the word tablet, but then Makari Lauren, the actress, is not signing tablet. So that's actually what's going on this morning, trying to make sure that Lauren is happy and doesn't feel misrepresented, just as if we tried to shove a word into a speaking actor's mouth, which we do all the time to make things happen. It's just with a signing person, you can't really cut off camera, right? So it's a little different dynamic for us as editors to try to make that work and how you do overlaps. So we were extremely thoughtful about it and cautious and, you know, checked it all with Lauren and her people so that everything was exactly correct.
To my mind, it's the same as what you do when you're translating from another language. It's as precise as you can be, but because it's a different language, it's got to be slightly different to make sense of it. And then we've got Babylonian, which three people on the planet actually know, and we tried to be true to those three people.
And there's real Babylon. I mean, that's right. And people are speaking real Babylonian. We had a person translating, and I learned some Babylonian to try to help Leah get through that. We spoke Babylonian to each other for about 2 hours. It was quite impressive.
How did you two collaborate during dailies? And then how did that change once you started breaking the films into reels and seeing things more in context?
When we're finished with a scene, we'll show the other. The other will make comments, and sometimes we'll go, no, I wanted to do it this way. But it's that, just talk a lot.
Often we'll run into each other's room. We check with each other how we were intending arcs to go. Or
I would run into Dylan's room, but Dylan would get Christina to slack me. Oh, no.
This is not true. One of the reasons is that I sometimes work with my monitoring level down a little bit and sometimes with my door closed because it helps me concentrate. Craig works at full level with his door open all the time. So in fact, okay, I knew exactly what Craig was doing. So I didn't have to.
I like everyone to be involved. I said that as a joke, but I do it seriously because of that. I actually like to be interrupted by assistants, and we didn't have our assistants with us much on the show. And I miss that. I like someone interrupting me.
We had a Zoom channel that was called The Hallway that was basically all the assistants and music editors and stuff just on a Zoom that stayed up all day long, and we could jump in and out as we wanted.
Next to
Craig
me
would just leave it on all day long.
I just left it on with my camera running, and I could talk to any of the assistants in kind of real time like you normally do.
So this movie was literally edited on a 2-year-long Zoom call?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, many, many Zoom calls. And Marvel's process for that is the executives come in the cutting room and go through scenes and reels at least like twice a week. And so we kept that up, but just remotely.
I remember the first time Kevin was able to come back in for a person.
It was such a good day.
Editorial session. He was in such a good mood, and he was so happy to be back with us in editorial.
And we were happy too. It was fun to be in person.
Do you guys remember how long the first cut of the film was as you came out of dailies?
7 hours, Steve. It was 7 hours long. No.
That is not true.
It was a little over 4 hours, I guess.
I think it was, four or five.
I remembered it being 3.5, but.
Well, we quickly got it to 3.5, yeah. I remember talking to Tim Squires once and saying my most anxiety-producing time is the first cut, is the editor's cut in dailies, because the possibilities are endless, depending on the movie and the footage, but the possibilities can be endless. Often we are deciding how to start a scene, how to end a scene, what performances to use, what things to accentuate, what things to de-accentuate. A lot of decisions that often, 90% of those carry through the whole movie to the end. You're making decisions that affect how people even interpret the movie. And then Tim said, my favorite part is the first cut because the possibilities are endless. So we agreed, but we had the opposite opinion. I quite like fine cutting where we've decided kind of what we're doing and now we're just making it better and better. It's more about sort of sculpting and amping the joy of cinema up, rather than pulling my hair out trying to solve issues, which, you know, I love that too, but it is much more of a stressful sort of period.
Talk to me about safeguarding the quieter, slower moments of the film. You know, as we've talked about, that's what makes you care about what happens in the big explosive moments. You know,
it's just whether you miss them or not. You know, you've got to just feel the movie. If you've taken too much out, you go, I'm not feeling anything anymore. You've just got to feel it.
You know, people call it slow when it's dialogue rather than punching and flying. But that's not slow to me. If story is moving, if ideas are moving, hopefully that's not slow. And the challenge is to keep people paying as much attention to what's being said in the back and forth character moments as, you know, when people are being slammed up against walls and volcanoes are exploding. They're both almost equally effectual in how the plot turns out and what's going on. And it should be. That's the ideal. And so with this movie, and often with movies where you have a slower pace in sections, the challenge can be picking your babies. It's always a balance. You know, Cersei as a character doesn't have the proper arc if we don't see a sacrifice that she's made in order to lead. It's faster. You'll feel better in Reel 7, but by the time you get to the end of Reel 8,
you won't feel as good in the action.
Once she gets down to having to make that decision, you don't care anymore because her character hasn't been set up. And that's a very important and sophisticated issue with editing that I think a lot of people don't get when they're watching a movie. And they shouldn't. It's our job, but it is often a very delicate balancing act.
I feel that action can be slow if it's not feeling like it's advancing the story at the same time. So if you haven't set up your characters to care, and you don't check in on your characters through the big action finale in a way that's adding to them, then you're not going to care about the action. And so that's going to feel slow and boring.
Craig, even after editing Guardians of the Galaxy and multiple Pirates movies, you've edited several short films. What does that do for you? Why do you cut shorts?
Because it's fun.
Because it only takes a week.
No, because the couple of shorts are people that I wanted to work with for various reasons, but it's also a brief form of storytelling. It's the same as when I used to work in commercials, that you learn your skills of telling stories in very brief ways. What is really the most important thing to tell this story? It teaches you efficiency.
And shorts can be very fun because, like short stories, they're often only one act. Really, you know, you're not doing the three act thing or four or five or whatever, but it ends with a revelation and a summing thought that's a little open-ended. So you walk away thinking a lot more from a short, I find sometimes.
Love it. And Dylan, I noticed that you were second unit director on a film, and that's a role that I've seen filled by editors multiple times. Why have an editor as a second unit director?
The editor should know the material that the movie needs and can get efficiently to the verb, as it were. The editor not only knows the style of the film, but is also very clear, I need these three shots and they need to look like this. You know, technically, that's the reason that editors often are a good choice for that. I mean, I shot all the action on this little movie that I did with Drew Barrymore, that all roller derby, you know, action stuff. And that was just all the action, you know, first unit shot with the principal actors. And then I did everything else with the stunt people. And that wasn't worked out at all. We just sort of devised it as we went. It's not always just the little bits that drop in. It's also sometimes, you know, big chunks of things that the editor happens to know what's going on.
Guys, thank you so much for joining me and congratulations on a great film.
Thank you.
Thanks,
so
Steve.
Much. This was fun.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. It's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for film professionals of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to my guests, Craig Wood, ACE, and Dylan Titchener, ACE. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.